Hello and welcome to this Constitution Unit event on Riding the Populist Wave, the UK Conservatives and the Constitution. I'm Meg Russell from the Constitution Unit and I'm really looking forward to chairing this event. As you know, we've got two speakers. Professor Tim Bale from Queen Mary University of London is the author of numerous books and articles, many of them with a focus on the UK Conservative Party. He's also a well-known and fluent media commentator. The title for this event is inspired by Tim's latest co-edited book, which I've got here, Riding the Populist Wave, Europe's Mainstream Right in Crisis, with a picture of Boris Johnson on the front cover, just as a clue. And it looks at the response by centre-right parties, like the UK Conservatives, to the growth in support for the populist radical right. The book looks across many countries like France, Italy, Germany, Austria, and the Netherlands on a wide range of issues. But it includes some quite chilling warnings for what the influence of the populist radical right might mean for our political institutions and the health of our democracies, which are issues we thought we should explore in the Constitution Unit event series. So Tim brings a combination of deep understanding of UK politics and the UK Conservative Party with this very important broader comparative understanding of political trends. Our second speaker is Daniel Finkelstein, who we're very delighted to welcome. Daniel Finkelstein, Lord Finkelstein, who will give some reflections on Tim's analysis and its resonance with the contemporary Conservative Party from a somewhat insider perspective. Daniel has been a Conservative peer since 2013 and previously served as an advisor to Conservative Prime Minister John Major and party leader William Hague. He's one of the UK's most incisive political commentators, particularly through his weekly column in The Times. So the format for the event is that Tim will say a few words about the analysis in the book in his opening remarks. And then Daniel will give some opening remarks of response to Tim. We may then have a little bit of back and forth between them if they want to question each other. I will throw some questions at the panelists, and then we'll move over to questions from you, the audience. If you've got a question that you'd like to put to the panel, please write it in the Q&A function as opposed to the chat. And my colleague, Lisa James, will act as the Q&A facilitator, selecting a range of questions, and she'll by default ask the person who submitted the question to unmute themselves and ask it directly to the panel. If you'd rather not ask your question directly, just indicate this when you're submitting it, and Lisa can ask it on your behalf, and you can also submit anonymously. This whole session, including the Q&A, is being recorded and it'll be posted online on the Constitution Unit website, our YouTube channel, and it'll form a Constitution Unit podcast after the event. So you may want to bear that recording in mind when you decide the basis on which you want to submit your question. That is more than enough from me. We have a fantastic panel here. I am enormously looking forward to what they both say and to our conversation afterwards. So let me hand straight over to Tim to get us going.
Thanks very much. And thank you to Danny and everybody who is helping to put this recording together. A couple of weeks ago, I started feeling a pain in my chest. And about a week after that, I said to my wife, I probably should ask the doctor about this. I felt a little bit silly because it was only a pain in the chest and I'd had no kind of breathless symptoms or anything else. But I did get an appointment with my doctor, albeit one over the phone. And she diagnosed me incredibly quickly. Asked me a few questions, and within a minute told me that I had something that was in fact very common, even though I'd never heard of it. And it's something called costochondritis, which is something to do with the cartilage that joins your ribs to your sternum. The main treatment for this is just to leave it or to take non-steroidal anti-inflammatories known as ibuprofen to you or ibuprofen to the rest of us. In my case, that was a problem because I don't tolerate ibuprofen particularly well. And indeed, it can often make any condition that I might take it for rather worse in the sense of giving me a stomach upset. And the long-term consequences of me getting a stomach upset aren't that great because I also have a problem with my gastrointestinal tract, as do many people. So it's something I want to avoid doing. So in the end, what I did was to completely ignore the advice to take ibuprofen and just let the whole thing resolve on its own, which eventually it does seem to be doing. Now, the reason I share this bit of my medical history is not because I particularly enjoy doing that over social media, although, of course, I do, like anybody. And it's not because I want people to know about this apparently very common condition that I never heard of and still can't really spell. It's actually because I think it produces a useful analogy for a point that I want to make, or a question in some ways that I want to ask today. And that's namely whether we, or at least people on the centre right, are so concerned about halting or even turning back the rise of radical right-wing populists, that what we do to counter it might actually have implications or side effects, if you like, that are in some senses worse for society than would be the case if we simply accepted that the populist radical right is here to stay. It is, if you like, more normal than pathological. And rather than taking some of the measures that we do to combat it, we should perhaps just accept that. Now, the background to all this, as Meg has already outlined, is the book that I've co-edited with my co-editor, Cristobal Rovira Calvasa, who comes from Chile, and our contributors who come from all around the globe, actually. The point of the book really is to look at how centre-right parties deal with some of the challenges that they've been facing for the last three or four decades, not just the populist radical right, but there is a bit of a focus perhaps on them. It's important to do this partly because the centre-right is actually rather neglected in comparative studies. And you know, I think that's something that we do need to correct. We've been trying to do that for some time, not particularly successfully, I should say. Not quite sure why. It's always been the case, perhaps, that political scientists have been slightly more on the left than they have on the right, and that might explain their greater interest in social democracy and the extreme left on occasions. And there's no doubt that the populist radical right is just far sexier and more interesting to political scientists and maybe to journalists as well than their, you know, rather duller mainstream right counterparts. But those mainstream counterparts actually form governments all over Europe, have done so for decades and continue to do so, despite the fact that actually they've suffered a considerable electoral decline over the last few years. And that's particularly the case for Christian democratic parties in Europe, but it's also the case to some extent for conservative parties, and less so for liberal parties. And those are the parties that we concentrate on. When we're talking about the mainstream right, we're talking about Christian Democrats, conservatives, and market liberal parties. Now, one obvious cause for the decline of those parties is the rise of the populist radical right. To some extent, they inhabit similar political space to the mainstream right, particularly when it comes, for example, to nationalism, when we're talking about the conservatives, or socially conservative policies when we think about Christian Democrats, liberal parties less so. And perhaps that explains why liberal parties of those three party families don't seem to have suffered such an electoral decline. And certainly if you look at voters and you look at something called propensity to vote, you will see that voters for the mainstream right are significantly more likely to skip across and vote for the populist radical right than are voters for the centre-left. Although very often we concentrated on the idea that it's the centre-left who's been losing votes to the populist radical right, simply because those voters often seem to be working class. And there's a kind of assumption or an elision, if you like, or a logical leap that says because the radical right's voting base in some countries is working class, therefore it must be the left that has suffered the desertion of those voters. It is slightly more complicated than that. And of course, even when it comes to the mainstream right, it's slightly more complicated than that. The recent German election, I think, is a case in point, where we've talked a lot in recent years about the threat that the Alternative für Deutschland, the AfD, has maybe posed to the CDU-CSU. But in fact, the recent German election, you will see that the CDU-CSU lost fewer votes to the AfD than they did to the Grim Reaper. In other words, they lost more voters because those voters had died than they lost to the AfD. In fact, other parties lost more to the AfD. And if you look at where the CDU-CSU lost votes, it was to their mainstream centre-left competitor, the SPD, and also to some extent to the Liberals, and also, interestingly, to the Greens, which brings up the fact that, as we say in the book, mainstream right parties have faced a dual challenge, if you like, or at least a sequential challenge, some might say. The first being what Ron Inglehart called the silent revolution, this gradual progress of more liberal views and values across electorates, particularly as they became more educated, that we've been seeing really since the late 60s and early 70s, where we see a gradual rise of what some people would regard as post-material values. Those obviously do challenge mainstream right parties, particularly where they're quite socially authoritarian or socially conservative, where they're quite nationalistic. All those things don't really chime very well with a more post-material agenda. So that silent revolution has posed a problem for the mainstream right, and it's one that we don't perhaps often think of, but it is important. Where I think there is a bit more attention paid is to the backlash, if you like, to the silent revolution, the so-called silent counter-revolution, as Piero Ignazi calls it. And that's where we see the rise of the populist radical right. And in some ways, the book tries to concentrate both on that and on the challenge that's been posed by the silent revolution. And as Meg says, we did some case studies there. And we also look in particular in all the case studies at how those parties have responded in four areas: welfare, attitudes to European Union, on moral issues, social policy, some people might call it, and on immigration. The clearest effect of the social of the silent revolution has been on moral issues, if you like. You can see that all those mainstream right party families have gradually moved towards what you might call a kind of more progressive set of values, relatively speaking, than an authoritarian or socially conservative set of values. And the biggest effect of the silent counter-revolution, as you would expect in some ways, has been on immigration. And you can see very, very clearly that the mainstream right, all those parties of the mainstream right, have moved towards more restrictive positions on immigration over the years. But moving away from the book a little bit, although that's the sort of jumping off point, what I want to do in the sort of last few remarks I want to make is talk about the response of mainstream right parties to the rise of the populist radical right in particular. And there are really kind of four things you find mainstream right parties doing. The first is to kind of resist it and maybe even to huddle together with other parties, not necessarily in their bloc, in order simply to try and freeze out the populist radical right. And you can see that that has been the case in some ways in Germany for some time. It's impossible for the CDU-CSU to have anything to do, at least at the federal level, they think, with the AfD. So therefore, we've had grand coalitions, for example. And you can see this in other countries as well. The second option is for parties to adapt and to adopt in some ways the policies of the populist radical right. And you can see this going on in many, many countries. France is an example where you see that the mainstream right in France has moved, and in fact, in real time is moving towards more socially conservative, socially authoritarian, restrictive policies, for example, on immigration, in response to the rise of, you know, both the Front National and now this guy, Eric Zemmour. The third option is to actually get together with those parties, to coalesce with them, either officially and join in a coalition with them in government, or just to have them as support parties supporting minority governments of the mainstream right from the outside. And we've seen this very clearly, for example, in Austria and in the Netherlands over time. And the fourth possibility, and this is the one really I want to concentrate more on today, is the morphing of these mainstream right parties into what you might refer to as sort of ersatz populist radical right parties. In other words, to beat off the challenge of these parties, one can argue that mainstream right parties have almost become, in some ways, populist radical right parties themselves. Now, most worryingly, this has occurred, for example, in Poland and in Hungary. You see Law and Justice becoming a populist radical right party. You see in Hungary, Fidesz, which started off as a liberal party, becoming a populist radical right party, in part because of the threat that was posed to them by parties to their right, the LPR in Poland and Jobbik in Hungary, but there are other reasons as well. And this is where we then move to the UK, where arguably what the Conservative Party has done in response to both UKIP and the Brexit Party is to move towards a more populist radical right strategy itself. And this is where some people at least are worried that in so doing, what we are seeing is a case before our very eyes, if you like, in plain sight of what Ziblatt, for example, would call democratic backsliding. You can look at some of the measures outlined in the Tory manifesto, some of the measures currently going through Parliament, which would suggest that some of the measures taken as part of this transformation, if that's what it is, are quite worrying to fans of liberal democracy. Just to give you a quick list, and I won't go through in detail, we can talk about them perhaps in more detail, but these are the kinds of things that people who are worried about this bring up. So there's the elections bill, so messing around with the electoral commission and the governance of the electoral commission, also introducing voter ID when there doesn't seem to be a very good reason for doing so, redefining what election campaigning constitutes, and therefore perhaps making it more difficult for third parties to campaign on behalf of political parties, or at least in a way that would benefit particular political parties. We also have the idea that judicial review is going to be to some extent qualified or pared back. We have the police crime sentencing in courts bill. I hope I've got that right, but it might be might not be the exact same order. We have some measures in there, particularly in terms of limiting people's right to protest, that are causing quite a lot of concern. There was an article by George Monbiot in The Guardian this morning worrying very much about that. We've had allegedly intimidation of the BBC, albeit informally. We've had an attempt to try and install someone who didn't seem particularly suitable as the chair of Ofcom. We've had a prime minister who does not seem to take the ministerial code too seriously. We have, of course, before Brexit, the prorogation of Parliament, the unlawful prorogation of Parliament. We have, in more recent times, obviously, this question of standards, parliamentary standards, and moving away, if you like, or trying to move away from a more independent oversight. Now, those are individual examples, but for some people, they add up to a programme which is undermining, or risks undermining anyway, liberal democracy. And there's a very interesting Constitution Unit blog, actually, on this by Haggard and Kaufman, where they talk about the collapse of the separation of powers, the lack of protection afforded to basic political rights, for example, freedom of expression, and tinkering with the integrity and eroding the integrity of the electoral process, all of which they say tends to take place against a background of polarization, check, a fairly acquiescent legislature, check, and also occurs in a kind of incremental way rather than a kind of big bang way. So really, I guess I would say that at the moment, this is the charge seat. I'm not altogether sure that we can convict yet because it's very early days. The problem with that rather benign interpretation, of course, is that much like COVID, if you leave it until it is very, very obvious and you absolutely know that liberal democracy is being undermined in quite malign ways, then it's probably too late to do anything about it, which is why some people want to flag it up earlier. So that comes back really to the main question of this. And it's one to which I at the moment, I think, have an open mind. It comes back to, you know, my medical history. Is the cure worse than the disease? In other words, how serious do the side effects of the rise of parties like UKIP, the Brexit Party, maybe Reform UK, who knows, with all the concern about small boats, they're not necessarily over. How serious do the side effects have to be before we wonder whether it might simply be better to put up with the ailment rather than necessarily to take some of the measures that this government seems to be taking in order to transform themselves into a different kind of party, partly in order to stem the challenge from a party on its flank.
Terrific. Thank you, Tim. And yeah, thank you for plugging that blog post. I very strongly recommend it. Haggard and Kaufman also draw the analogy of the frog in the pan, which I think fits very nicely with what Tim is saying, that you may not realise how much danger you're in until it's too late. And I should also plug the fact that Tim has an excellent blog with us on some of these issues related to this about the Conservative Party. And I'm hoping he may be appearing again after this event. I'm going to mess actually with the schedule here just for a moment. Daniel's unmuted quite correctly, but I just think it might be useful to ask one point of clarification to Tim, because I think there's a little gap in what you said. Very briefly, could you join the dots for our audience as to how you get from responding to the populist radical right, which, as you say, is about things like moral issues and immigration, to shutting down checks and balances in constitutions, the types of things that you're talking about?
That's a really...
There's a gap via populism and what populism stands for. I think it might be just useful to summarise before we move to
that. I think that is a really good question, actually. And in some ways, it's an awkward question for me, because I think there is a degree of slippage there. It's not, you know, automatically obvious that this will be a consequence of responding to the populist radical right. I think it's more in some ways a kind of byproduct of doing so. I think the policy adoption is more obvious in a way, but I think once you go down that route, and I think on Brexit, the government had to go down that route of adopting a much harder Brexit than perhaps, you know, some in the Conservative Party and indeed, you know, many people in the nation would have wanted. I think they moved towards a position where in some ways they then, arguably anyway, bought the whole package. So I don't think there is necessarily a logical link. I don't think there is an inevitable cast iron link between, if you like, adopting some of the rhetoric, some of the techniques, some of the policies of the populist radical right, and this kind of democratic backsliding. I would see it more, as it were, as I've said already, as a kind of a byproduct, if you like. Once you go down that route, it seems to, some people would argue, not oblige you, but lead you perhaps to doing some of the other stuff as well. But it's a very good question.
Well, maybe we'll come back a bit more to that in discussion, perhaps, and how you wind up with people like, let's stay away from the UK for the moment, very privileged people like perhaps Donald Trump speaking up against the elites on behalf of the people, which is part of the populist package. But we've delayed Daniel too much. Apologies for that. I know you've looked at the book and you've listened to what Tim has said. So we would love to hear your reflections from a Conservative perspective.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, first of all, I do encourage everyone to read Tim's book. I thought it was really, really interesting. And I think his intuition that there isn't enough academic work done on the mainstream right is completely correct. And he's played a large role in trying to tackle that. You know, a lot of the work on the right is historical and not contemporary, and I think that he's correct in thinking that we need to tackle it. Secondly, I didn't disagree with the basic analysis that he outlined, but I probably do disagree a little bit on degree, but only a little bit at the end, so I'll come to that. Let me frame it in the way that I do, but I don't think you'll disagree with this framing. It's just the one I use. I just before Brexit happened, I pointed out that I thought that there was a contradiction in Brexit between the politics of Brexit and the economics of it. The economics of it is, to make Brexit a success, you have to reduce taxation on companies, you have to reduce regulation, you have to increase spending on research and development. This has a lot of pressure on public services and it concentrates on the working population rather than the retired population. It means you need a highly educated workforce. In other words, that the economics of Brexit completely contradict the politics of it, where the votes for Brexit were coming from people who effectively were from the group that you would tend to move economic policy away from. Public service hungry, older people, often living in declining places. And you can see that tension happening in politics the whole time. You know, if you wanted to personify it, the government has got an argument going on between the economics and politics of Brexit between its chancellor and its prime minister, right? But this is a bigger gap. It's between what I call two countries, Livia and Romania, okay? The problem for Conservative parties, they want to simultaneously retain a voter base among prosperous business-orientated people and some newly disaffected voters who are more culturally conservative. And this was also a problem in the United States. And Donald Trump succeeded in uniting these two very disparate parts of the Republican coalition with larger and larger amounts of racial provocation and cultural conservative provocation, which has produced an almost unhinged Republican Party, actually, which is problematic in lots of ways, one of which is that, you know, the Republican Party helped the Conservative Party form the International Democrat Union. And I don't necessarily think it is true that the centre-right is united or democratic or internationalist, right? I think the Republican Party is headed away from all three of those things. So I basically accept the analysis and I can understand why the Conservatives, one might imagine the Conservatives will go down this route. And there's another thing, which is there are plenty of Conservatives who can see this and do want to go down this route, either by inclination or by strategy. Part of the problem they've got is it won't work in this country because in the United States, you've got a different racial mix, you've got a different history of racial politics, you've got a different cultural gap. And I'm also pleased to say also within the Conservative coalition, I think there is just less inclination, right? Boris Johnson, despite superficial similarities like his hair, isn't Donald Trump. You know, I always used to make a joke sort of 10 or 15 years ago, don't attack Boris Johnson too much, liberal conservatives might need him. Because at that point, I certainly saw that as being his politics, right? I mean, there's a lot of water flown under the bridge since then. But that is where there's a sort of, as you both know, no one goes to the bank based on promise from Boris Johnson. But nevertheless, that is where I think his basic politics are. There are lots of reasons why the Conservative Party can't follow that. But you can see its inclination. I often used to describe the Dominic Cummings press briefings as being like the Bond villain who's always telling Bond what he's about to do. And then just before he privatizes the BBC or closes down the Supreme Court or sends the House of Lords to York, you know, a sort of anvil falls on his head and his headquarters explodes and it doesn't happen. I think that's a bit like, and the Conservative, but paradigm example of this is all this talk about the European Court, the European Human Rights and Human Rights Act. In the end, the Conservative Party will come back with Human Rights Act reforms, which will drive everyone crazy and make absolutely no difference whatsoever. The courts will still continue to interpret because they won't leave the ECHR, right? That's for all the reasons I suggested they won't do that. In other words, they'll hover on it. So what I'm I think your analysis is correct, and you're also right to sort of say, have you got enough evidence to convict? I think there is, but nevertheless, we're right to ask these questions. The problem with the frog in the water analogy, right, is that it then, and this kind of, you know, we need to be worried about something happening before it happens, is that you then get worried about something that isn't happening on the grounds that you think it might be about to happen, and we're all certain this can happen. And I sometimes think the debate about some of these things then ends up being not particularly valuable. Let me give you an example of the elections bill. So I have obviously got to make a decision about whether I vote for the elections bill in the House of Lords when it comes there. And I set about researching this terrible bill and all the bad things about it. And I ended up coming to the conclusion that it's probably true there isn't much of a problem of voter fraud to solve. And it's also probably true that it won't suppress anybody's vote either. In other words, the whole row will be completely pointless. In the end, I don't think the election bill, and I'm less familiar with the proposals relating to the Electoral Commission, I have to say, but I don't think the election bill is an example of democratic backsliding, because I think there are very good democratic arguments for using identity, and the suppression evidence isn't that strong. That's an example. Another example is the protest bill. Well, yes, it is a human right to protest. It's also a human right to walk down the road. Those are both human rights, and you have to hold them in balance. Political protest is incredibly important. So is getting your, an ambulance being able to cross Westminster Bridge. And you have to have laws that protect both those things. They end up being questions of judgment for the police. Then we have some big questions about whether we trust the police. But what I'm saying is it is complicated. I think it is right all the time to be vigilant. I certainly have several times made it perfectly clear that I could never support, for example, the removal of the Human Rights Act. I think that the proroguing of the proroguing of Parliament was an outrage, and it needed to be opposed, and opposed loudly, and explained why it was a problem. So it's right to react strongly and sharply to these things, but it's also important to show a sense of perspective a little bit. And I sometimes think analysis of Boris Johnson is undermined by the assumption that he is Donald Trump. The metaphor isn't very helpful sometimes in trying to help us understand what he's going to do and what the Conservative Party is going to do. I don't want to be regarded as complacent, but it's simply not the case that this is Weimar Germany, right, effectively. One last point. I do have something that I regard as a solution to all of the problems that we've been discussing, and that is economic growth. Lots of these are problems of low economic growth. In low economic growth, groups can't get money simply by sharing out the extra money that everyone's earning. People begin to think somebody else is earning money that they should be earning. People have that inclination anyway. They think they're putting in but not taking out. If there's economic growth, they'll think that. Economic growth will also grow cities and towns, who will then educate people. The education will lead people to greater liberal social outlook, and it will move the whole of the political spectrum towards greater tolerance. It will reduce the threat made to conservatives by populist movements. It will remove a lot of these political antagonisms. I don't want to be too economically determinist, but I think it's the most important thing we can do is all begin to work on what we think will increase this country's rate of growth, given that we've decided that we're going to not be members of the European Union.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Daniel. You've thrown down some challenges there. Before I forget, let me plug another Constitution Unit blog post or several. It's great that you're briefing yourself up on the elections bill. If you haven't got to the stuff about the Electoral Commission yet, there are a couple of really good posts on our blog by my Deputy Director, Alan Rennick, on that very topic. And many people are finding them quite convincing. So whether that stuff's still going to be in the bill when it gets to the Lords, I don't know, because people were beginning to talk about this stuff in connection with Owen Paterson. Tim, would you like to come back? I think the big challenge there from Daniel is whether there's a greater danger of sort of hypervigilance rather than complacence.
Well, I guess that depends on what the costs of that hypervigilance are. If hypervigilance actually encourages people in the government to be a little bit more careful, a little bit more wary about taking some of the measures that perhaps some of the more hot-headed members of the government would like to take, then that can only be a good thing, I suspect. I'm not quite sure what the downsides might be, other than perhaps there's always the kind of crying wolf risk. And I agree, even, I must admit myself, if I read some articles in, well, let's say The Guardian, for example, you know, warning about, you know, the dreadful things that might happen. There is a degree to which, when they don't happen, I suppose I become slightly immune or inured to the arguments of those commentators making them. So there is perhaps that risk. I mean, I think in terms of the actual legislation going through, I mean, Danny's absolutely right. The proof of the pudding in the end is what actually comes out of the sausage machine, you know, when the bills become an act. And we have to wait, you know, inevitably to see what happens with that. I mean, I think clearly some of the things on the right to protest are quite worrying. I mean, I talked about articles in The Guardian, but I think the Monbiot article is worth a read there, because, you know, it does seem that there are some things being introduced perhaps at the last minute into the Lords rather than the Commons, although I don't really see that that's a great problem that will have to be looked at. But then perhaps we can trust people like Danny. I'm sure we can trust Danny.
To be clear, I should have said also that my comments mostly refer to the bill that was published before the new proposals, and I have to read those new proposals and satisfy myself about that, because, just for example, I'm not satisfied with the travellers' proposals in the current bill. So there are details of the current bill that I can't accept. I think that the proposals on confiscation are unacceptable. But just to give an example, an answer as an example to you, if people watch the television and they can see that protests that they regard as completely unreasonable, that is repeated attempts, for example, to sit across the motorway in order to make a point about insulation, which you completely can make inside the democratic political system, then after a while you do begin to build up kind of worrisome populist attitudes, right? It will not be my attitude, then you won't have to worry about that, but you do build up. So you have to have law, you have to have a proportionate law, and the balance has to be struck, because the right to protest is a really, really important right, but it's not the only right. And I remember I wrote this somewhere, and somebody said, "You're saying your right to go to pret-a-manger is more important than the saving the climate." And I said, "No, my right to go to pret-a-manger may be as important as your right to sit in front of the door with a sign saying 'Save the climate,' right?" You know, I'm just saying those things definitely have to be part of the debate, because if we don't strike a reasonable balance, you'll lose to unreasonable people, and that's all that I'm arguing. But the problem with them is you have to be careful all the time about individual measures. So I can't just give a sweeping endorsement of measures that I haven't had a chance to study carefully yet.
And the other thing I was going to say, and I'm going to be interesting to hear Danny on this, is whether the more informal measures that some people suggest the Conservatives are taking, with regard, for example, to, you know, the governance of Ofcom or the chairman of Ofcom, whether, you know, some of the so-called intimidation of the BBC that goes on, whether those things are, you know, as worrying in some senses, or even perhaps more worrying than some of the stuff going through the legislature, which, after all, is subject to, you know, people like Danny actually scrutinising it.
I was very worried about the BBC one. The Ofcom one is a very interesting thing. So I ended up not writing about this, because, personally speaking, I wouldn't want Paul Dacre to be head of Ofcom, be chairman of Ofcom, because I read the Daily Mail in the last 2 years of his editorship. And, you know, for all his great editorial ability, I thought it was a bit bonkers. That was the truth of it. And so I didn't say it. But I did have a problem at one point that the decision to appoint him was like he couldn't be appointed because he didn't hold a consensus liberal viewpoint. And I was a bit worried about that, even though that's my viewpoint. So in the end, I sort of thought, well, someone else can make the argument in favour of somebody whom I don't agree with doing something. But I was a bit worried about it. Are we really saying that because Paul Dacre, who supports the BBC, but it has kind of conservative political attitudes which are quite widely held, that therefore in and of itself makes him an inappropriate person to be chairman of Ofcom? Now, I'm not about to appoint him chairman of Ofcom, which is the reason why I didn't write that, but I was a bit worried about that whole argument. And I do think we have to be careful that we don't sort of think nobody must be allowed to to hold these kind of attitudes, which are kind of quite widely held. And I often hear that in the public debate. It worries me a bit.
Mm. Can I leap in and start throwing some questions at you? Because we're in danger of crowding out the audience if we're not careful. Sorry. One of the questions I was going to ask maybe a little bit later, but I think now feels like the right moment, given the conversation you've just been having about hypervigilance versus complacence. I mean, it feels to me that one of the things which is very useful about comparative political study, comparative study in general, I always say to my students, is that it gives you a perspective on your own system. And I would ask Daniel whether he thinks there is actually a bit of a danger of this sense of British exceptionalism that we tend to have, that we're so special, that, you know, we don't look beyond our own shores, that what's going on is kind of uniquely British, that books like Tim's do actually flag that maybe there are things going on here that are part of a broader global movement. The blog post that you referred to as well on backsliding did the same, that actually you see these kind of eerie resonances in the UK with stuff that's going on in other places that we are worried about. Do you think that there is a sense on the Conservative benches of that place in the world, of that sort of broader perspective that maybe ought to make us not entirely complacent?
Look, I think that what's happening in parts of Europe and the world is pretty worrying and does, you know, I think Tim's book was quite persuasive. There is definitely an analytical question and, you know, this a new division between less educated and better educated people as being one of the primary moves all over the world is definitely applicable to Britain. The framework works. So I do think you're correct in thinking that we must guard against feeling that Britain's immune to these things. On the other hand, I also think there are some aspects of Britain that are, you know, different. And I just, you know, I was talking to you about writing about my parents. I'm doing a book about my parents and their experience. Both of them were refugees to this country. There's no question that the political attitude in this country, which was had like lots of the same resonances, but it was also quite different as well. So I think the answer to your question is yes, there's lots we can learn from reading what's happening in other countries. Because of its massive influence on our political system, what's happened in the United States on the Republican side is truly shocking and potentially a really cataclysmic world disaster. You know, Noam Chomsky at one point said he thought the Republican Party was the most dangerous political force in world politics, and it was risible when he said it. Now I think it is among them, right? I think it's in the sense that it might undermine the most important country to our sort of to the security and continuity of a Western liberal approach. It might undermine their ability. If Donald Trump gets re-elected, for example, that might easily have that effect. And I think that might also, you know, to answer your question, Meg, it might have a knock-on effect on conservatives who get attracted by the idea that it was electorally successful. They begin to wonder how to deal with this dilemma I talked about. They see that Donald Trump has dealt with it successfully. And I was interested. I definitely had to fight some of that off before the 2016, before the 2020 election in the US, you know, in among British conservatives. But interestingly, never that vigorously, because most people could see that he was a bit bonkers.
Tim, one of the things that does make us not entirely exceptional, but fairly exceptional within Europe is our electoral system. And notwithstanding the experience in the States, where obviously they also have a first past the post system, I just wonder whether you could reflect on the difference in dynamics. I mean, some of the things that you talk about, that you mentioned earlier, that you talk about in the book, the different responses is, well, you go into coalition, you form grand coalitions, or maybe you invite the populist radical right into your coalition. Actually, first past the post means we don't normally have coalitions here. So in a sense, the pressures here ought to be very different to what they are on the continent, and yet we seem to be going down this road as well. Can you untangle that a bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Well, one of the things that we did, you know, when we came to conclude on the book was to see whether electoral systems made much difference to the responses of mainstream right parties. And actually, they didn't seem to play that much of a role, apart perhaps from the UK, where, as you say, some of the more obvious responses, and particularly this sort of coalition response, is to all intents and purposes denied the Conservative Party in this country. I mean, there was a remote possibility that they could have done a deal with the DUP, but it's very difficult to see actually now, especially how there are any parties that the Conservative Party could do a coalition deal with, or even a kind of, you know, confidence and supply arrangement. So that
there's a supreme irony, isn't there? Yeah. That, I mean, obviously, to do a coalition deal to be in government, you have to be in Parliament.
Yeah.
And the pressure in the UK has been primarily through UKIP, which, yeah, of course, won its seats through the European elections, which were on a proportional system. And Brexit has ended those elections.
Yeah.
So they are effectively locked out, at least for the meantime, aren't they?
Yes, and it will be interesting to see whether, in fact, the absence of those European elections actually means that the Reform UK can't do what UKIP did, because it doesn't have that periodic, spur, as it were, every 5 years. But I mean, what's interesting, I think, is that, you know, as I say, electoral systems, they're important, but they're not determinative. For example, if you look at both the Conservative Party and the CDU-CSU, they've both pursued a strategy throughout the last few decades of basically never allowing a competitor on its right to emerge with any, serious potential to upset government or upset the system. And those are the ways that they both played it. And it was successful for a very long time. I mean, you know, we can go back to Margaret Thatcher and the National Front, et cetera, et cetera. The Conservative Party and the CDU-CSU, generally speaking, have been pretty good at that. It's just that it's broken down in recent years because of the rise of the populist radical right, you know, for whatever demand and supply reasons we can come up with, and that's a whole, you know, different debate, really. They're no longer so able to do that, which presents them with a problem. In some ways, it's even more of a problem for the CDU-CSU, because it then limits the number of coalition options they've got. But it's also a problem for the Conservatives. And the way that the Conservatives, I would argue, have actually handled it is to become, you know, rather more like UKIP, like the Brexit Party, than perhaps many people in the Conservative Party would particularly like. And the question for me really is whether that is some kind of permanent transmogrification of the Conservative Party, or simply, you know, another episode in the Conservative Party's ability to, you know, morph and mutate according to whatever it needs to do at the time to get into power. And that, therefore, if the second is the case, we shouldn't expect the Conservative Party to, you know, be like this for that much longer, unless, of course, they face a renewed threat from Richard Tice and Reform UK, or even some would say, God forbid, Nigel Farage getting back in the game as he was hinting last week.
There are so many questions I would like to ask here. I think we need to get to the audience very soon. So let me just ask one more, and then I'm going to be very frustrated. I hope the audience is asking all the questions that I wanted to ask. But again, following on from what Tim has just said, I think there is a natural question for Daniel, which might more naturally belong at the end of this seminar, but as to, you know, what the potential directions for the Conservative Party are, because as you've said, Tim, there are lots of people who are quite unhappy about this direction of travel. We saw this with Labour under Corbyn, you know, talk of splits. You know, can the party really hang together if there are some in the party who are pursuing these kind of populist directions, which are quite anathema to some conservative traditions of maintaining our institutions, of having the rule of law, checks and balances, and so on. But of course, the party system, kind of the electoral system, forces parties together as well. But another element of kind of broadly constitutional arrangements I would connect this to is the reform of mechanisms, democratic mechanisms inside political parties, and the rise of member power, which was part of Corbyn's rise, of course, and his grip on the party that meant his parliamentary party couldn't even get rid of him. And I think that plays a part in this story too. I mean, I ask myself now, with what the Conservative grassroots is like, whether the party could elect a moderate leader now.
It could. So it could. So there are a number of things, and I haven't sort of got time to to sit down and think how they all link together. But first of all, one of my arguments against the political direction the Conservative Party has taken is that the country is going to become liberal, more urban, and the Conservative Party is and more diverse, and the Conservative Party is voter base moving in the opposite direction, and that's not a long-term strategy. It may work in the short term, and the answer that you get back from people is, well, when that happens, we can move to that position, because the Conservative Party is always do, to which I reply, well, it'll be harder than you think, and you'll have to go through the same process of modernization that is very difficult, as every political party finds when it tries to do it. And nevertheless, I think that such a moment will come at some point. I'm not sure it'll come immediately. Secondly, I think there is a chance that the Conservative Party will begin to become undermined by the Reform Party, particularly if Nigel Farage were to involve himself in it, but even with Richard Tice, because the Conservative Party doesn't satisfy part of the populist voter base. That's partly because nobody could satisfy it, because its fundamental premise, which is that there is a will of the people and they represent it, is untrue, and therefore you can never falsify it by anything, because they believe something, sort of the whole party's sort of based on a belief that's sort of almost magical, really. And so I don't think that will ever happen. But then that sort of intermediate, the third point, which is what I'm not sure how it fits together, is I think the Conservative Party will, its members' voter base is more pragmatic than that suggests, Meg. And the Conservative Party has always been a little bit less ideological, has been less ideological. But the reason why I'm hesitant is because Tim is the expert on this. Demographically, it's highly unrepresentative. But the people in the party are kind of their views are more extreme than their demography. Is that a fair summary of it?
Tim is unmuted. I think you can say the same in both parties, can't you? That the party grassroots is very different to the party electorate.
It is, but it's the Conservative Party, its grassroots, I mean, it's the danger for the Conservative Party is its grassroots ends up being quite representative of its electoral base, but it's not wide enough. But I think that what I'm saying is that the Conservative Party membership is kind of quite politically representative of the demographic groups it consists of, but it consists of a lot of old people, that is problematic. But I think that the next leadership election, whenever it comes, it'll depend a little bit on it, probably will be less ideological than the last one, because the last one was ideological partly because of Brexit. But also, I think Boris Johnson could have got elected at any point in the last 10 years as leader of the Conservative Party, because he just was very popular with Conservative grassroots members for all sorts of different reasons, not just because of his views on Brexit.
Which perhaps goes back to another thing that you said before, that if he'd been elected quite a few years ago, would he have been a very different kind of prime minister from the...
Yes.
Governing very much from the centre outside of Brexit times. We must go over to Lisa, I think, to start pulling in some questions from the audience, because we're hogging all the time. And if we run out of questions, I've got plenty more. But Lisa, what have you got?
Well, no fear of that. We've got some really interesting questions coming in from the audience, which I've loosely grouped by topic, and we're going to ask them in groups of two or three. Audience members, I know some of you have submitted more than one question. I'll point you to the one I'd like you to ask. And if you could limit yourselves to that one so that we can get to as many people as possible, that would be much appreciated. So first of all, we've got a group of questions on the mainstream right and the British Conservative Party. So first of all, Shanti Chakravarti with a question on tensions in the mainstream right between economic and social policy. Then Robert Morland on the role of the rule of law, and Robert Greeley on conservative thinking.
So Shanti, would you like to unmute and ask your question?
Well, the question was actually asked by your representative. Is that one of the problems of when you think about conservatism, and this I found with Thatcherism as well, was that there is this view of Friedman's capitalism and freedom, Nozick's anarchy state and utopia, and then there is the view of Norman Tebbit. Now, there is a tension already within conservatism. Now, what I see with the populism is that this tension is actually coming out much more in focus, because some of these Tebbitism, if you take it further, then becomes Carriageism. And maybe that there is an irreconcilable tension. And I see that with the independent, the European group, the IRG. The other day, somebody interviewed Steve Baker. He had on his desk a book, Anarchy, State and Utopia by Robert Nozick. And I could not think of anything more different in ideology than what this government is.
Okay, I think we must move on to other questioners. If you could try and keep your questions short and snappy, that would be good. But I think that very much touches on some of the things that we were already talking about inherent tensions, which we see on the continental, in the continental parties as well, as reflected in Tim's book. Robert Morland has unmuted. Would you like to ask your question?
Yes, I've always thought that historically the Conservative Party has been always fairly strong on the rule of law. And indeed, when we had at the end of 2019, the threat to break the rule of law on the Northern Ireland Agreement, I think a lot of Conservative MPs were unhappy. So I'm wondering, although we've talked about the direction is a bit more towards breaking the rule of law, whether actually the basic Conservatives will actually in the end halt that. It will be difficult to sustain.
Internal market bill, difficult moment for the Conservatives. And Daniel voted against that one, I think. And Robert Greely, finally.
Hi. So obviously populism isn't exclusive to the political right, but in of late, Conservative parties across Europe seem more prone to sliding into illiberal forms of constitutionalism. So in the view of the panel, beyond the political pressures facing these parties, what is it more specifically about the morphology of Conservative thought that seems to render its followers more prone to these slides into illiberal forms of constitutionalism? Thank you very much.
Very interesting. Shall we start with Daniel and then go to Tim? And don't feel you have to answer all three of the questions. Pick up what you would like. And well, pick up what you'd like, Daniel, and Tim, you get left the difficult.
Well, I think that it's correct that the Conservative Party do what used to be strong in favour of the rule of law, and that a Conservative Party that would ignore the rule of law isn't a Conservative Party, and it's not a political party that's supportable, really. And I was worried very much about the Internal Markets Bill, about the kind of whole rhetorical attack on courts. I worry about the judicial review provisions. Those are definitely reasons for Tim's slight pessimism. I did think Dominic Cummings kind of pretty much explicitly doesn't really believe in. Well, I don't think he really believes in parliamentary democracy and the rule of law, despite the fact that he has many other brilliant points to raise. Those are pretty much knockout things from my perspective, made it very difficult. And I think despite his intelligence, the government is better off without him as a result of that. Whether or not the Conservative Party is resilient on those things, that's going to be a test to come. Right? Sometimes I am optimistic about it, sometimes I'm not. I think it's definitely the right area to be discussing. Whether I agree that the right is more inclined to illiberalism than the left, I'm not sure I do think that. I mean, I think that Jeremy Corbyn's entire leadership that entire strand of thought is about the idea that there is a kind of direct democracy on the shop floor that trumps parliamentary rule of law. I didn't accept that either. And so there are always people who think the world would be better off if they didn't have to consult anyone else. You know, we all have a slight inclination to that. And the good thing about a political system is in a constitution is it should prevent you being able to act on that thought. Because it reminds you that it's not true, but I'm not sure the right's more prone to that than the left.
I would say in terms of the last question, I think Danny's right. I think both left and right, particularly kind of the more extreme sides, if you like, of left and right, and I would include, the Labour Party and the Conservative Party in that, or parts of them. They have made a fetish of executive power. And you know, once you do that, you know, there is a risk that you slide into that kind of a liberal democracy. But I don't think it's necessarily just a right-wing thing. In terms of the tensions within conservatism, and I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you can see that in immigration, in migration policy, and, you know, all over Europe, really. There is a tension that conservative parties and to some extent Christian democratic parties face as well over immigration. For Christian democratic parties, it's not so much a mismatch between their kind of economic policies, which were always a little bit more centrist and less, if you like, neoliberal, to use that very loaded term, and more the fact that actually Christian democratic parties have got the very strong sense of internationalism and welcoming refugees, etc., and charity. So taking a very hard line on immigration is really awkward for them in that respect. For conservative parties, it can be really awkward because, as Danny has already referred to, you know, when he talks about the politics of Brexit and the economics of Brexit, you know, there is definitely a contradiction in some ways between wanting, you know, the liberalisation of markets, if you like, and free trade on the one hand, and on the other, then, you know, the possible limits to that if you fetishise sovereignty, whether it be, you know, in terms of movement of people or in terms of, you know, protecting your markets. And that is something that, you know, the parties, you know, do face real problems with. And that's in some ways one of the problems for parties which coalesce with radical right parties, because, you know, there's an extent to which they can, you know, create a division of labour within a government and say, well, OK, populist radical right, they can look after kind of immigration and kind of, you know, law and order, and that's their thing. And as long as they let us get on with the sort of economic policies, which will continue to be business friendly and liberal, etc. But it's actually quite difficult to do that because one bleeds into the other. So those tensions are there, and in some ways I think they're irresolvable. I mean, I think the one thing that perhaps makes conservative parties slightly more inclined to do deals with populist radical right parties than centre left parties are to do deals with, you know, far left parties, is that, you know, on the question of nationalism, particularly, I think, obviously, for conservative parties, that's something that they find fairly easy. You know, there is a you know, a slide of one into the other there, and they can work together on that basis. But for Christian democratic parties, even that's very difficult.
Thank you very much. Let's go back to Lisa, who promises us lots of questions.
I do indeed. And the next set are all to different extents challenging some of the things that we've heard. So we'll start with Jamie Fisher, who has a question on the role that's played by the radical right in democracy. Then to Sean Hanley, pleased to ask what you called your devil's advocate question. And finally to Brian Walker, who has a slightly similar question about a specific historical piece of context.
So if we accept that populist parties and their leaders can act as a corrosive force in democracies through their employment of zero-sum game politics and their tendency to construct a sort of hypothetical people as a body that excludes minority groups, would the panel also accept that populist parties can provide an avenue for political representation when entrenched consensus takes the politics out of politics? I sort of asked this question thinking of an article that Professor Bale published in 2018, where he spoke about David Cameron adopting more liberal positions than previous Conservative leaders, and that alienating traditional voters and them then going to UKIP.
Okay, that's great. Thank you very much. And Sean.
Okay, thanks. So here's my devil's advocate question. It's not really perhaps surprising that British Conservatives want to reverse some earlier reforms and sort of go back to what they see as a more sort of traditional and authentically British kind of model of democracy. And especially given the aftermath of the Brexit referendum result, when some Remainers really didn't want to abide by the result, including me, I should say. So my question is this: how can we spot the difference between a reform of democracy, which simply moves in a particular, more majoritarian direction, and democratic backsliding? Because as a student of Eastern Europe, I don't see Hungary as remotely like Britain, even in 2010. So I think there's some potentially some concept stretching there. Thanks.
That's a really fascinating question. Thank you. And then Brian.
Listening to the conversation, it's terribly rich. I just wonder how you're going to sum it up, assuming Meg asks you to do that. And I think that'll be very difficult. My question is actually almost embarrassingly simple. Are we perhaps a little bit too hard on Johnson? I mean, what's going on at the moment is perhaps largely beyond the reach of party structure and ideology. And while the Constitution Unit is absolutely right to hold the government's feet to the fire over violating norms, perhaps when you look at the huge problems, the emergency responses to COVID, climate change, weakened parties, the fragmentation of opinion, gaping social inequality, and not least the threat to the survival of the British state, and there has to be a lot of room for manoeuvre that perhaps we're not giving him enough allowance and cutting him enough slack for.
Okay. And I should say that Brian specifically in his question asked, how would we view Johnson in the context of somebody like Lloyd George, for example, and is there a historical comparison there?
Yes, I didn't want to talk about that, but it's one of my favourite topics.
Tim, would you like to go first this time?
On Jamie's question about the populist radical right, I mean, I think you're absolutely right, Jamie, to say that, you know, they do play a valuable role. I mean, there's no doubt that, you know, despite the fact that, you know, they to some extent push parties in the mainstream into doing things that I personally disagree with, they are also a signal, a canary in a coal mine, if you like, that, you know, politics has lost connection, or the political class, to use that rather populist phrase, has lost connection with some voters, and that it needs to do better in explaining to them or actually giving them what they want than it has been over the last few decades. So, you know, in as much as politics and electoral success is a signaling game, I think they are very, very important. And, you know, coming back to what you said, I said about Cameron, I mean, I do think that that is to some extent true. I think there was a diagnosis on the part of David Cameron that the Conservatives' problem was the loss of, you know, liberal middle class voters, and he was in some ways right to say that, and certainly right to say that in the long term. The problem is that, you know, if you move in that direction, then possibly you lose people on the other side as well, and you create a vacuum into which UKIP poured, and then there is a correction in some ways when we get to Theresa May, and then particularly to Boris Johnson. The question, I guess, is whether that's an overcorrection. And some people who are worried about democratic backsliding might suggest that it is an overcorrection. And that goes to Sean's devilish question as well as devil's advocate question. I mean, I think in some ways I'd repeat what Danny said. I'm not sure where differences of degree and differences of kind begin and end. I mean, I bow obviously, Sean, to your better knowledge of Eastern Europe, and I think you're absolutely right to say that it's all too easy, I think, particularly if people are writing columns, and I'm not talking about Danny here, to sort of talk about comparisons with Hungary, talk about comparisons with Poland, and you know, without really sort of going into the detail of them and getting people to realise quite how bad things are in those situations, and quite how, in some senses, sort of marginal our concerns in the UK scene. I'm going to leave the question about being too hard to Boris Johnson to Danny, because I know he might pick up the Lloyd George thing as well, because he's an expert on prime ministers, having read a biography of every prime minister we've ever had. He should know a lot more about Lloyd George than I do.
Okay, Daniel, give it a go.
So the first thing I would say is, I thought it was a good thing to raise the question of the reaction to the referendum result. One of the things that happened, and David Cameron at the same time, one of the things that happened was this outpouring of fury at David for having called the election, for having called the referendum in the first place. And when I was trying to get my head around the argument, and it appeared to be this, because people wanted to leave the European Union, it was absolutely mad of David Cameron to ask them what their opinion was. And what we should now do is rectify the mistake that he made by stupidly asking people to do that, forcing them to answer the question again in the hope that this time they would get it right. And the idea that this wasn't going to produce, as a result, partly as a result of this, Theresa May's softer version of Brexit was defeated. She was forced to resign from office on the assumption that she was like the worst prime minister ever because she couldn't solve this conundrum. And Boris Johnson got elected. What did people think was going to happen? And one of the answers on the question of populism is, you know, we do live in a democratic country, and that doesn't mean, that is not entirely defined by my urban liberalism. Right. It's also defined by the views of everyone else, one of which was they wanted to leave the European Union, right, which was a big commitment. So the suggestion is that we should have committed ourselves in perpetuity to a European Union, which is increasingly forming itself into more like a state against the wishes of most people. Now, it was, by the way, you know, on balance, I did want to stay in the European Union, but it did seem amazing to me, not only, and then having done that once, then wanting to repeat it till people got it right. So that is part of my sort of slightly passionate answer to this. It always sets me off when people start attacking David Cameron for having held the referendum. But because I think it gets to the heart of this question. Then quite separately, your thing about Lloyd George, I think it's a really interesting and good comparison, actually, in character, because people do, I hadn't really sort of contemplated it. I'm now going to look at it a bit more closely. In some ways, Lloyd George was disreputable. In many ways, he was kind of quite messy and mercurial. Interestingly, he had this relationship with Bonner Law, who, despite being in a different party, served a kind of moderate Lloyd George's impulsiveness, and didn't necessarily always care that much about his personal ethics. I think it's quite a good comparison. The question of whether or not it will produce the same kind of happy outcomes as some of what Lloyd George did, that's a different matter.
Brilliant, thank you. We are on our official end time, so we better end there. This has been a fascinating discussion, and I just find myself very frustrated that we can't keep going for at least as long again. And I think there were more audience questions. Apologies to those we didn't get in. Apologies to anybody who thought we were selectively calling men to ask our two male panelists questions. The questions were absolutely dominated by questions from male participants, except, well, maybe some of the anonymous ones that we don't know about. So sorry about that. If women want to ask questions, then we very much encourage them to do so at our future events, but we have sadly run out of time. So I think it just remains for me to say thank you very much to all of you in the audience for attending. Thank you to all of those behind the scenes and to Lisa helping with the organisation. And of course, most of all, thank you to our two brilliant panellists. I should remind you to look for all of the various things on our blog that have been mentioned, some of which I know have been linked in the chat. I'm hoping that we'll be carrying Tim on the blog after this event. Daniel, if you've got any spare capacity, you are welcome on our blog anytime. Just to remind the audience that the event has been recorded and it will be up online very shortly, and it'll be forming a podcast. We will let you know if you registered for the event when the recording is available. And if you've enjoyed it, please do share it with your friends and family and encourage them to listen. Our next event will be in January. It's not finalized yet, but the plan is to hold an event on the future of the House of Lords. So keep an eye out for that one, and we hope to see you all at one of our events soon. Thank you again very much, everybody, especially our panelists.